This program is brought to you by the amazing FBA Mentoring Program. The mentoring program is there for you, whether you are just starting out or you have an existing product and you want to add another product, or you want to scale up from a few thousand pounds or dollars per month up into the sort of $25,000 a month or so mark, at which point then I would probably hand you over to the 10K Collective Mastermind if you're in the UK. Is it for you if you're outside of the UK? Absolutely. I've got an American client, a British client, weirdly, but who's in Australia. I've got an Australian client in London. I've worked with people in Poland and in Ireland. So it's pretty international. This works for everybody because everyone has similar issues. If you're selling in America, if you're selling in the UK or Europe, or you're planning to sell in UK, Europe or America, I've sold in all those marketplaces and coach people and all that. So all of those people will find that this is a very, very helpful program for them. Why one-to-one mentoring? It's pretty simple, really, because isolation is a dream killer. Trying to learn something just from the raw fire hose of YouTube and podcasts and Facebook groups is going to drive you nuts. But even if you've got the structured work of a course, which I definitely would recommend, I did that myself and I work with people with my course now, I still think it's really, there's no substitute for being able to use somebody as a sounding board, and learning from somebody who's been there before can help you deal with the head trash and have clear, simple processes and hold you accountable to them. So if that sounds attractive to you, guess what? We've got an amazing deal. I very, very rarely reduce the price of my mentoring because I don't want to devalue it in the marketplace, but I'm doing it because I neglected my marketing before Christmas with the PLP, the private level process course I was creating, and I've got a tax bill coming up because I've had a successful year, but that unfortunately means I owe the government a lot of tax. So for those reasons, I need to get a cash influx, so I'm willing to lower my prices for the next three or four people. After that, goes back to standard prices, and I will indeed put them up in future, as I have done in the past. So if you're interested in exploring that, it's application only. I'm not going to hard sell you into anything. If it's not right for you, we won't work together. But many, many people have found it very helpful. If you want to find out more about that and see some of the testimonials from the happy people that I've worked with, amazingfba.com/ mentoring, MENTORING. Thank you so much for listening. Now on with the show.
I hereby introduce to you Mr. Michael Veazey.
Hey, hey, hey. Welcome to Amazing FBA, the place to be for UK-based Amazon entrepreneurs. I'm your host, Michael Veazey. Welcome to the show. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Amazing FBA. This is your host, Michael Veazey. Today we're on the 9th of 10 steps, part of the Build Guide series. You can download the guide as a free PDF, which has been nicely designed by somebody who has a design eye, which is not me, but I have worked on the wording of it with my coach. So I really tried to distill down the wisdom of nearly 4 years of helping people build their, like three and three quarters now years of helping people build their Amazon businesses. And I really think we've got a way of doing things that's quite different from the standard advice in the private label space. So just a very quick recap. This is the ninth step. So very quickly, the first step is modeling peak performers. I think you need to draw on multiple industries and different categories on Amazon and different businesses and different people as well. If you just base it on one person who's managed to make maybe a substantial amount of money with 4, 5, 10 SKUs in one category in 2014, which is quite typical, and that's very impressive and all that, but it's not a very good basis to generalize on because it's too narrow a base. So that's the first thing. Be careful who you model from. The second thing is about learning via retail arbitrage, quick and dirty arbitrage. Not about making money. It's about learning skills. The third thing we talked about is the overall process, having a clear process. And our process is the NSL process, which I'll remind you what that is in a second. The fourth one is learning your skills at a basic sort of level, on a test level, trying to basically do a test launch for under $1,000 if you can. And that's a bit of a challenge, but it's a good number to aim for. And then NSL, of course, that stands for the niche research. So picking a winnable Amazon market and one that's worth winning, sourcing for profit and quality, and planning your launch, and then measuring everything as well, measuring the result of all those activities. So what we come to now then, after all that, you may feel like, well, you know, that's the traditional private label thing. Do your research, source some stuff and launch. Sure. But the difference is that until this point, we haven't actually done a private label launch if you followed our system, which is very advisable. Some people just ignore it, but they don't do as well as the people who follow it, in my experience. So arbitrage first, test launch, where you go through a lot of the same things that you're going to do on the full scale launch, but you risk a lot less money, right? So that's basically following the same principle that I didn't even know it was called this until recently, because we'd basically come up with this on our own because it was in response to our clients' needs and what worked in our own business and what in our client businesses. But what's been formalized by Jim Collins in Good to Great and Great by Choice and his other great books as the fire bullets, then fire cannonballs philosophy, which basically says if you are innovating, if you're doing something new, and by definition, anyone who's starting a new business is extremely, you know, innovating relative to what they were doing before, then you shouldn't just trust your data and research in the abstract sense, but you need to get into the market and do a market test. And it's all relative to your own resources. If you've got $10,000 or $10 billion, doesn't matter. If you spend all of it on one or maybe two very big unproven projects, that's very likely to end in failure. So then about 25% of the time that works. According to Jim Collins, I would say about one in five, so about 20% of the time that works, and the rest of the time it doesn't. So much wiser is trying out several different projects or new products that you think based on your research should work. And of course you should do your research and run your numbers and talk to people and do quality research. But in the end, trying to predict how the market's going to react without actually having experience of selling to a market is very hard to do. And it's not necessary. You just need to have a way to test things. And only then should you be thinking of scaling up to the winning products. So you out of, say, you've launched five products on a test scale, maybe one, maybe two of them will look good, and then you can pick one of them, or even if you have enough capital, expand both. If you're new to the game, I would say, though, you're probably working very part-time on top of a day job or an existing business, and so you should, because you shouldn't be planting a seed one month and then, you know, trying to eat the sapling the next month. You'll kill your fledgling business, okay? Do not do that, even if you can afford to. So if you're new, and most of people listening to this will be, if it's relevant for them, or if you are, you know, still working the day job, I suggest launching one product at a time. So that's what I would say. Doesn't stop you gradually in expanding that over time. We'll talk about that in the next episode. But what then is the difference between selling the off-the-shelf generic design in a ready-made packaging versus our private label, more expanded launch? Well, it's a lot of the same things, which is good. Doing the same thing multiple times is how you get good at things. So repetition is the mother of skill, as they say. So that is a good thing. Do not look down your nose at that. On the contrary, be glad, embrace it. That's how you get good. That's how you get systematic. It's how you get it into your bones, as opposed to just intellectually understand things. There are a few differences. So the first thing is your niche research or your market. You need to refine your customer avatar based on who has actually been buying your stuff. You may have thought that your plastic widget was, which held iPhones, was going to be used by 20-something men, and maybe women in their 50s are using it, in which case you may want to talk to them about their particular needs. They might want a different sort of design for their aesthetic sense, for example, right? So that might be something that affects your design, your product creation and product sourcing decisions. You may want to redo the market research around keywords. I think that's a very good idea to make sure that you're really targeting the right keywords. And that's when looking at your data, as we talked about in step 8, can be really, really fantastically helpful. The data of, for example, Amazon ads, when you've seen that quite a few ads with certain keywords have not really performed well. Either you didn't get many impressions, in other words, your ad didn't show up very often, which probably means, amongst other things, that maybe not that many people are searching for it. But also, you can see which keywords have got clicked on and actually made you sales. And that's really, really powerful data. And you cannot get that data from the outside, as it were, without actually selling on Amazon. So that's very, very powerful. And then reviews, of course, if you've had any reviews, or even if you haven't, and in some ways it's better if they haven't appeared on your listing, but people have written into you, or you've actively, through your email follow-up sequences, encouraged people to get in touch with you and tell you what they actually think about the product. That's really powerful, because again, that can help you iterate on the, you know, the actual design of the product. And that is something you can possibly consider doing when you're sourcing private label. So that brings us to the second thing, which is with the private label type launch or product order size, as opposed to the generic smaller test order. The first thing is it's a bigger order, right? Normally, if you're going to create your own private labeling, so you get the logo typically stamped on a product, depending on what the nature of the product is, it may be screen printed onto a bottle if it's supplements or something like that. If it's a plastic thing or metal, it gets stamped or screen printed on or whatever it is. And then your packaging as well will normally be unique. Now, our packaging is a whole different area when you're not just taking off-the-shelf design, but going for your own. And that can be a great way to add value. It's worth spending $1 or $2 on packaging up a widget, which is in itself only maybe $3 or $4, because it will add a lot of value potentially, especially if it's giftable. And we're just coming into Q4 now. So if you're scaling things up at this point, it's early September 2019, as we record this, really important in the sort of Christmas time of year, particularly to make things giftable, all sorts of things you wouldn't imagine giftable are. It's amazing how sales rise for every product category, not every single one. Supplements, for example, don't tend to be very seasonal for Christmas. They're more seasonal in January, February, March. And I'm not an expert in supplements, so I don't sell them. But for a lot of things, the packaging can be really, really important. So you need to think about the product features as well. Now, that's when you start to edge into the sort of custom manufacturing thing. But if you're just tweaking the design as opposed to really changing it completely, you just need to be careful about things like patents. And it's beyond the scope of this quick overview to say much about that. But if in doubt, you need to use the Google Patents search. Just Google Patents or Patents, P-A-T-E-N-T-S. And just double check that the design that you're wanting to sell isn't patented before you go into it. And if in doubt, you're going to have to spend some money on a good lawyer. Again, a good time to do it before you scale up rather than when you start, when you have nothing valuable, or when you've already scaled up massively and you're risking it, right? I've had patent infringements that I've unfortunately made without realizing that my suppliers basically did not do their due diligence on patents in the USA. I was buying from China, selling in the US. Turns out that was not legitimate. So you need to do your homework. I'm not an attorney or a lawyer. So in the end, guess what? Do your work on Google Patents if you can. If you need a lawyer, then hire one. And if you can't afford one, then you may not be able to afford to go into private labeling these days, because you probably want to protect yourself pretty strongly against that kind of thing, because it really messes your day up if you get an intellectual property claim that people can substantiate of how it happened. Fortunately, I only lost a couple of thousand pounds worth of inventory, but it was still painful. I say pounds, I mean, as about $2,500 Americans. I'm not talking about £2,500 weight. That would be quite a lot. Anyway, so those are a few of the things you need to look out for at this stage. The other thing is rigorous quality control. You can get away with getting some widgets off the shelf if you're buying 100 widgets at, say, $5 each. You know, that's not a great deal of money you're risking. So if it goes horribly wrong, you can just shut down your Amazon listing. And unless it's gone really grievously wrong, in which case it might shut your Amazon account down. So I'm not suggesting that you ship complete rubbish to Amazon, but even if you were skipped over the quality control at the sort of smaller test order / generic launch phase, it really is not a good idea when you're getting a proper size private label order of, say, several hundred units. Of course, it really depends on how much your units are each, right? By the way, the minimum order quantity is going to be higher, but it's not necessarily going to be vast. It's not about the number of units in the end. It's really about the sort of value of your order. And it seems to me, when I've been negotiating with the Chinese, in the UK, US, I haven't sourced him personally, but in the UK, you can get much, much lower minimum order quantities. And from people who sell in the States and source there, I understand that it's similar as well. So don't assume that it's going to be hundreds of units. If you're paying, say, $20 or $30 a unit, you might get away with a small number of units. So those are a few of the things that make it different. I mean, there's quite a lot that goes into this. In the end, if I really want to describe it in great detail, we've got quite a few things on the blog, which you can go to. If you search by category, if you go to amazingfba.com /blog, it'll actually confusingly take you to the podcast for Amazing FBA. And then you can search by category, amongst which is sourcing. And if you want advanced stuff, you can go to 10kcollective.com and you'll get straight taken to the advanced podcast. If you're listening to this one, that's probably too advanced for you right now. But we've got plenty of resources there on sourcing. And then
It's also something that is worth getting some input from someone who's been there before, I have to say. I'm not a world-class expert in sourcing, but I've done the basics of it multiple times and helped other people with it. So I'm probably about the right person to turn to if you're at the early stages. If you're more advanced, I will put you on to somebody who's an expert in that area. But if you want to check that out, you can go to amazingfba.com/one-off, 1-O-F-F, F for Freddy, F for Freddy. And I offer one-off services for fairly modest money, about £97 for a 1 hour consultation. That can be a good thing to get at this stage when it comes to sourcing. So the private label phase, the third area, of course, is launching. And that's not that different in essence from how you'd launch a test product, but it's all just done with more rigor, more depth, more expense up front, but hopefully a bigger win down the line. So the listing. Let's talk about the listing first. You need to have excellent professional photos. Even if you were somewhat cheapskate, or maybe just got two or three photos done, or found a way of doing it yourself with an iPhone, and there are quite a few bits apps and things you can use these days to improve the quality and process your photos, what you call post-production if you're a professional photographer. I'm not one of those, but friends of mine are. Rob Sleeth is the person that I would recommend the most. He was my business partner in Amazon business for quite a while, and also a very good indeed at product photography, because he totally gets the Amazon platform and has a massive background in photography as well. So the perfect person to go to at this point, you really want to go to an excellent photographer. Do not be cheapskate. Yes, it's got to be affordable, but apart from a good product, the most important thing you can do is get amazing photos. And by the way, amazing, but not misleading. If your photos look really different, for example, the color or the size or the finish, like, you know, is it plastic, satiny or shiny? Is it, you know, the metal gloss, etc.? If there's a violent difference between your photographs on Amazon as they appear on a phone particularly or on a laptop and the product as it appears when you take it out of the box, you're in trouble, because that is going to lead to all sorts of things, at the very least unhappy consumers, even if they don't say so via feedback or a review. But at the worst, they'll say to Amazon, it's not as described. And that's one of the biggest crimes you can commit in the Amazon space. And to be fair, it's kind of fraudulent to give people something that they thought it was A and it's actually B. But also Amazon sees it very seriously because the customer is king and they don't like displeasing their customers. So be very careful about that. So you need a photographer who understands that as well. So that's the listing photos. The other thing that is part of the image marketing that's really critical for certain types of products is infographics. For example, I got a phone case the other day, which I don't have handy, but it had a sort of blow up, exploded view of something, and it had about six different layers to it. It had sort of metal casing and then a rubber bit, and then your phone went there, and then there was a glass casing and then a metal thing and then screws that went in. And it showed all that in an infographic very, very clearly. And that was extremely important because that was basically the sole reason that I bought it. Apart from that single photograph, which was not the main photo, but one of the photographs, there was an infographic. It showed me a mixture of sort of photography and sort of diagram, exactly how it's put together. And that and the price, which was £15, with the nearest sort of tough looking iPhone case was about £40. And the fact that it was average 5-star reviews, that was what convinced me. So that's how it works. I mean, people will not generally read your bullet points. A few people will. You should get those right. But it is important, very, very important, to get your message across in the images. And infographics are extremely helpful if you have a slightly technical type product. Talking of the words, they do matter. I mean, most of all, what matters is the link between your keyword research, which you did in your first, you know, the first step of things. Niche research needs to be built into your listing, and you need to be very, very clear which are your most five sort of money keywords that you expect to do decent traffic and be winnable, even with a fight. And the second thing is then the benefits, which are not as important in my view, because you need to express them in infographics. However, if you can add a few percent to the conversion rate, that's money that you didn't get in essence. That's free money. So you really should work on that as well. So we talked about the images a lot, and that's because they're very, very important. We talked about the words, but what we haven't talked about is the how you're going to do traffic to the listing. And that's obviously very important. Again, it comes down to keywords. You need to know the keywords you're after. And again, if you've done a test launch, you've got some data, which is great. Build the keywords into your listing. The most important ones go in the title and the first bullet. The next most important on the sort of longer tail keywords, in other words, ones that are searched less often, but which you may be able to convert more easily on, you put lower in the listing. Now, once you've done that, you need to build some advertising campaigns around those keywords. And again, I'm not here to teach you that particular skill set, because that's a lot that goes into that. We've done a recent very good interview on the 10K Collective podcast with Brian Johnson of Canopy Management, who also ran PPC Academy. So he's very, very expert at teaching people how to do this, but he's also good at breaking it, the simple stuff down. So although that podcast is geared to advanced sellers, I think his explanations are very good for people who are just starting out as well. So go check that out on 10kcollective.com and look down look through for Brian Johnson. So high Amazon ad spend, what else? I'm afraid the other thing is low pricing, right? Because high Amazon ad spend means that you're giving it the best possible chance of visibility on the platform. Low pricing simply means when people see it, you know, if your product ranks, and that's the first thing, you must have the right keywords in, you must be targeting intelligently with your ads, but it's not actually rocket science, really. I mean, there is a little bit of rocket science, but most of it is about clarity and your market research and understanding your customer. The second thing is, once you get your customer, you've got to give them a reason to buy. And when they've never heard of you and you don't have many reviews, one of the reasons is excellent main photography, of course. Relevant title helps, but really the price is really important. As you gain more reviews, as you gain more social proof by being higher on the page, guess what? You can charge a higher price. And you can also, as you start to rank towards the top of the pages you're aiming at, meaning, for example, if you're selling an iPhone case, you rank for the word iPhone case 6S plus or whatever it is you're trying to rank for, you can then back off the advertising gradually, right? You gradually pull the ad spend down, you gradually pull the price up. And guess what? You need to budget for the fact that you will make a loss on every sale when you start. And that's not because you messed up. That's because you got to buy your way into these markets. Nobody's just going to sort of roll over and say, oh yeah, come and take my market share. It's a fight. Okay. You've got to give people a reason to buy. You've got to start off when you launch with the lower price. And that's the reason to buy. What you're trying to do is prime the pump. You're kicking off the algorithm for organic search results. What does that mean? It means if people see your advert because you're bidding enough and they click on it because it's relevant and they're bidding enough and your deal looks attractive. That is a blend of your reviews, the average reviews, how many stars you got, the price, and the main photo, right? So that looks attractive and it's relevant. People will click on it. By clicking on it, that tells the algorithm, Amazon's brain, oh, it's relevant. So I'm more likely to show that ad next time. And I'm more likely to think about showing the organic search results for your listing in response to that keyword, right? If people then, once they've clicked on the ad, they actually buy the product. That gives more juice to the ranking algorithm for that particular keyword for that particular listing, right? So that's how it works. And the aim is to prime the pump by starting off by selling mostly via PPC, mostly via ads, and then gradually making the proportion of ads-driven sales a lot less. So most of your sales are organic, therefore much more profitable. And over time, then you bring the price up and the ad spend down, right? So I hope that made sense. That's one of the simpler explanations I've tried to give about this, but sometimes it takes getting your head around it. Again, doing something is just a better way to really, really understand. They say, I hear and I forget, I see and I remember, I do and I understand. And there is something in that, actually. I mean, podcasts are inspiring. Sometimes I listen to them a lot, of course, and that's why I started one. I still listen to a lot of them, not always Amazon-focused, but bigger business picture sometimes Amazon-focused. But in the end, there's nothing like doing stuff. So a podcast can be great inspiration to check something out and go deeper into it. And that's great. And I hope that I inspire you to do that with Amazon. But in the end, you have to do this stuff, right? This is why, again, doing a test size order before you do a big order enables you to sort of square the circle. On the one hand, you don't know what you're doing, so you need to get experience. But on the other hand, if you don't have experience, you shouldn't be spending a lot of money yet. And squaring the circle comes from the test order. So the first time you do a proper big private label launch, you've got to recognize it's still a test. So the fourth part of it, the learning and reflecting on your experience and examining and analyzing the data, is really important as well. Just a couple of things on that. I mean, the first thing you'll find is an irresistible urge. If you get the Amazon seller app on your phone, or if you're on your laptop, same difference, but even worse on your phone, an urge to check your statistics 20 times a day will overcome you. When you're new, that's okay. The urge to change everything every day will be on you. If you have a day where you have two sales and you've previously had eight or nine a day, you'll be tempted to change everything in your listing. Change the price, maybe change some of the photos, mess with the text in it. Do not do this, okay? One of the most important things I can possibly tell you, and I was saying to a new mentoring client the other day who's launched a product recently and had fallen into some of those traps, but then had recognized it and stopped. The most important advice I can give you is this. Don't change everything at once. In fact, just change one thing at once and then give it time for that change to take effect. And if you're really rigorous about it, you need to then take time for that to be measured by the Amazon system or indeed any other systems you're using. So, for example, if you change the price, I mean, yeah, when you launch, you probably bid a low price. It might be you ratchet the price up from, say, $5 towards, say, $10 over the course of a week, and then maybe goes up to $15 over the course of the next couple of weeks, and then maybe your target price is $20, and you sort of edge towards $20 over another week. That's okay, but I wouldn't just mess with the price in big jumps up and down. That you need to have a clear idea what you're doing. If you change the main photo, do not change the price for at least 4 days, maybe seven, preferably, right? Because you don't know then which thing is having the effect. You need to be able to split up cause and effect as much as you can. And the other thing to say is that generally it takes a few days for the algorithm to, or the measuring data to be put into the system. There's a few days delay. Sometimes people will leave things in shopping carts for 48 hours before they come back and buy them and so forth. So the simple rule of thumb that I always heard, which I think is a very good basic, is test something for 7 days minimum and then leave it for 7 days and gather the data. Now, you probably just aren't going to have the patience to do that when you first launch your product, but at least test something for 4 days and then leave it three. All right. So minimum. It's hard to do this. It's an emotional thing. It's not about intellectual insight. This is about not messing with things, because what you get is just messy data then. You need to just do something. If it's a disaster after 3-4 days, okay, change it. But if it's a disaster after 1 day, that means nothing, because that's random variability. You're going to get some days where people buy and some when they don't. So in conclusion then, the most important thing about this whole thing is what you've done before this point. If you go straight into private labeling without doing a test phase and without bothering to learn your skills through arbitrage, I think you're just taking very unnecessary risks out of impatience. And I don't think it's going to serve you well, because what normally happens to people who do that, I've worked with them before and I've tried to, you know, I've adjusted my approach based on that, is that they either just get too scared to move at all. So in most cases, they just don't pull the trigger and do anything at all. Or they go ahead with a product, but it's like half their savings or most of their savings. It doesn't work perfectly. It's not normally a disaster, but if it doesn't work, it means it doesn't sell very well, or it's just not profitable, which is very common. And by the way, that can often be fixed, sometimes not. Depends what it is. And I can't go into the detail here, but you need to look at it in detail. But most people give up at that point, and that's why people fail. So the solution is, you know, get to the point where you're scaling up only those products that have proven themselves. You vastly increase the probability of success, vastly reduce your risk. And because the risk is low, you're going to actually do it. You know, most people don't do anything. This is the main reason people fail with their Amazon businesses. I mean, most people who buy a course don't actually watch any of it, apparently. This is the rule on the statistic. There's lies, damn lies, and statistics. Who knows? I mean, like 80%, who knows? As Seth Godin said, 83% of statistics on the internet are made up. Yeah, maybe. My experience is like, yeah, maybe 80-20 means that 20% of people who buy a course actually take much of a significant percentage of it. That certainly seems to be true with the PLP course that we offer, sadly. But those who follow through on it, I mean, they can get to the point where they sell. Most people don't go any further than just having a bit of a dabble. But there's nothing that means that you have to do that. I've got two mentoring clients who I worked with a while ago, one of whom I worked with maybe 3 years ago now. worked for a while. He had a bit of an issue and a hiccup and he stopped at that point. And I thought he'd just given up on it, like most people do when they hit a problem. Turns out he's done close on $1 million in a year recently. So that's pretty impressive. I mean, maybe it was 900,000, but it was pretty high number, pretty close, edging towards a million. He may have hit that by now. It was a few months ago I spoke to him. Another person's come back out of the blue who, again, I just assumed had drifted away to do other things. Turns out he did $250,000 in his first 10 months on Amazon. So he's probably going to be joining us in the £1 million mastermind, or sort of the 10K collective mastermind. So he doesn't qualify just yet for the £1 million mastermind. But you know, these guys are the ones who take massive action. And yeah, some of them have some substantial savings behind them, and that helps. And I'm not going to lie and say it doesn't. Of course it does. It's a capital intensive business. But the real difference, I think, is that people scale up and take their lumps at a small level. So you make mistakes, but you make mistakes you can survive. And you need to survive them financially, but you need to survive them mentally as well. Disappointment is never fun. And if you really want something, then the disappointment you experience when you don't really get it is more intense, which is fine. But the main thing is play a long game with this stuff. If you try and get launched and just grab anxiously something out of the jaws of the market that you think is going to disappear in a few months' time, really you shouldn't be doing it, because if it's going to disappear in a few months, it's not worth the effort that you're going to put in, okay? I think it's the same mentality that leads to day trading, which I'm not done, but as I understand from quite a few people, it's a risky way to try and make money. Whereas I do know the landlord that we had here up in North London has made several people millionaires from pretty modest investments, but it took a generation. It took about 20, 30 years. And I'm not saying you have to wait that long to become a millionaire by building a business on Amazon. It's not true. You can build it within a few years, but it won't be in a few months. And that mentality isn't going to serve you, because if you go in with that mentality, you're probably just going to run away scared as soon as something goes wrong. So in conclusion, yeah, scaling up in stages is really critical. But when you do scale up, just you've got a few more things that you've got to take care of. And that's what we've covered in step 9 today. So next time, the final step is really about getting clarity. And the way you do that is getting connection. And I think that's something really critical. Solopreneurs stuck behind a computer, that can be really difficult. I'm going to share the 3 C's with you, and I'll let you know what those are in the next episode in this series. Thanks very much for listening. Speak to you in the next podcast.
That's it. Thank you so much for your attention. I really appreciate it. Now, over to you. First, 80-20 everything. Learn the critical few. Maybe there's one thing in this podcast that can make all the difference. Find that thing. 20% of inputs, give 80% of the outputs. Which are the critical few for you? Then take action. Imperfect action beats perfect inaction every single time. Finally, and not least, review. If you've made mistakes, learn from them. If you've made a success, duplicate it. You can't do that unless you look back. So in summary, learn the critical few, then do, then review. And then, my friend, it's up to you. That's it. Thank you so much for your attention. Speak to you in the next episode.